This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
That whole politics makes strange bedfellows thing, never truer than today in New York City, people. Also on the broadcast today, oil on the rails and Moral Mondays in North Carolina. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's the 8th of July, Monday, and this is the podcast. Glad you could be with us. I know New York is our financial capital, but man, oh man, the politics there get curiouser by the very day. First, Anthony Weiner, the former congressman who got in trouble for tweeting lewd pictures of himself, decided that he was going to run for mayor. And now it appears Wall Street hasn't seen the last of Elliot Spitzer. Today, the former attorney general and governor of the Empire State, who resigned in a prostitution scandal, said he wants to be the new New York City controller. With all respect to city controllers everywhere, what? Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith explains.
It's an unusual move, but Elliot Spitzer isn't in a position to aim higher right now, says Larry Sabato, director of the Center for Politics at the University of Virginia.
It's a demotion, obviously. If he were to run for governor again, he'd be laughed off the stage.
Still, when it comes to Spitzer, there are no small roles, only small actors, says Sabato. 15 years ago, Spitzer took the low-key office of attorney general and became the so-called sheriff of Wall Street, suing big banks for trading abuses and the head of the New York Stock Exchange for his pay package. As controller, Spitzer could be the shareholder activist of Wall Street, says New York-based political consultant Hank Scheinkoff.
He is the chief investment officer, essentially, for the city, investing in the city's pension fund.
The city controller oversees $140 billion in pension money. Scheinkoff says Spitzer is likely to make avid use of that investment clout.
You have the proxy power because you're doing investments, and therefore you can use that to influence actions by corporations.
Public pensions, with their billions in assets, have leverage with companies, says Damian Park, a consultant for businesses dealing with activist shareholders.
There are several public pension funds that regularly engage in activist-style investing.
California's public pension system has used its muscle to oust CEOs. First, though, Spitzer has to get elected in New York. And an intriguing opponent just joined the race, Kristen Davis, the convicted madam who claims to have facilitated Spitzer's trysts as client number 9. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
The head of the National Transportation Safety Board said today investigators continued to go through the physical evidence from the Asiana Flight 214 crash in San Francisco over the weekend. They're talking to the pilots today. In Quebec, Canada, meanwhile, this weekend's deadly train derailment and explosion killed at least 5 people, with 40 more still missing. It was an oil train, dozens of tanker cars full of crude, one that are becoming increasingly common in North America because you got to go where the oil is. Marketplace's Sarah McCammon takes a look at the rapid growth in oil on the rails.
For most of U.S. history, oil refineries were built on the nation's coasts. They were also near the major oil fields. But now the oil boom in the upper Great Plains and Canada is changing all that. Sarah Emerson is president of the research and forecasting firm Energy Security Analysis.
The crude oil is up in North Dakota, and you have to get it to those same refineries, which are still on the coast.
The boom in oil production made possible by hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, has led to a spike in trainloads carrying oil.
We're really into uncharted waters at this point.
Stephen Shork edits the Shork Report, a daily look at energy markets. Instead of train cars filled with coal snaking along the nation's railroads, he says these days it's all about crude.
5 years ago, U.S. railroads pulled less than 10,000 carloads of crude oil.
This year, that's up to more than 250,000 carloads. Pipelines are another option, but there's not enough capacity, and major projects like the Keystone XL have bumped into public resistance. After all, pipelines can burst too. So for now, analyst Sarah Emerson says that means a lot of crude oil moving to the Gulf Coast, the East Coast, and in this case, the eastern coast of Canada, by rail. And she compares the train derailment in Quebec to the Deepwater Horizon spill in the Gulf of Mexico in 2010.
It's so big and so dramatic that it's going to make everyone stop and say, well, wait a second, should we be regulating this more closely?
So Emerson warns, get ready for a big debate over pipelines versus trains. I'm Sarah McCammon for Marketplace.
Oh, to be English after Wimbledon this year, huh? Andy Murray breaks a 77-year string of defeats for British men at the championship. And that's not all. Sport leads what you might fairly call a mini-series of positive developments in the UK, including some slightly better economic news. Could it be that the Brits are finally able to count their blessings? Our man in London, of course, reports.
Murray serves. Here it is. Here it is. Forehand from Murray. Backhand from Djokovic.
As Murray clinched victory, the BBC commentary said it all.
It seems ludicrous to say it!
Not it's incredible or it's amazing that a Brit has won the men's final at last. The commentator said it seems ludicrous. Fund manager Justin Urquhart-Stewart knows the feeling.
This isn't Britain. We're not used to this. We expect bad news. In fact, we possibly thrive on bad news.
Such is the British tendency to wallow in bad news that back in the 70s, this rock group felt the need to enumerate the reasons to be happy.
Reasons to be cheerful, part three.
One, two, three.
And the list of reasons for the Brits to be cheerful today is getting longer. Not only have they won Wimbledon at last, but a Brit's in the lead in the Tour de France. The weather's lovely and the royal baby is due within weeks. Florist Sarah Critchley is positively blooming.
Oh, well, I think it's been a fantastic British summer for sport and lots of other things. And when the royal baby arrives, we'll be wanting to celebrate, definitely.
And the economic gloom is just beginning to lift. Construction worker Pete Arnold is feeling more constructive.
It's all getting better now. It's gradually on the rise. We're getting there. Not out of trouble. We're getting there.
The good news seems to be helping, but Urquhart-Stewart says the Brits are never as optimistic as Americans.
You will assume in America that the glass is not half empty. You will assume it's half full. In London, of course, we assume it's not half empty. We assume the glass is actually cracked.
Make no mistake, he says, after all the good tidings, some bad news can't be far behind. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Stephen's a pretty optimistic guy, actually. Anyway, even the FTSE was up today. Wall Street mostly followed suit. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The latest from the wire services is that at least 51 people were killed this morning in Cairo. The Egyptian army apparently opened fire on supporters of former President Mohamed Morsi just after morning prayers. All the violence and the extended political instability has done nothing to restore Egypt's economy, which has been struggling for years and, in particular, since the first part of the revolution 2.5 years ago. Tourism accounts for about 10% of that economy. And until last week's coup, there had been small signs of a turnaround. No more, though. And people who work in the tourism industry are starting to get desperate, as Kimberly Adams reports for us now from Cairo.
That's the sound of 18-year-old Abdullah Ali jumping on our taxi as my translator and I try to get to the Giza pyramids in Cairo. The taxi driver starts arguing with him. Ali lets himself into the taxi, gets kicked out, then jumps back on the trunk to ride the rest of the way up to one of the seven wonders of the world.
I jumped on the car to help you, give you advice about the area, and to tell you it's a secure area.
Ali is one of a group of men literally blocking the entrance to the pyramid's plateau, trying to pressure us to buy carriage, horse, or camel rides around the ancient monuments. They get a commission if they sell one. These men are desperate for work, but when confronted about their strategies, Atrice Ali Atrice, who offers the tours, denies the high-pressure tactics, at first.
No people are going to jump in the car, you know?
But they did.
The people he jumped in the car, he didn't have any business for him, you know?
Atrice says he hasn't had a customer in 2 weeks, since before the latest round of protests. Warnings from American, British, and other governments to avoid travel here made things even worse. A few local families still take carriage rides, but the rare foreign visitors are in secure tour buses. Vendor tactics turned so desperate recently, the American embassy actually warned citizens about visiting the pyramids, saying the degree of aggressiveness in some cases is closer to criminal conduct. We take another taxi, and there's another near fistfight between the driver and vendors. And we arrive near the Sphinx, where we finally find some tourists on their own. Bowen Zhao is from China.
I like Egypt. This is my second time to Egypt.
Your second time to Egypt?
I think Egypt now is, I think it's safe.
But aggressive vendors soured his traveling companion, first-time visitor Eva Chen. Tourists that do visit are spending less, according to government statistics, and Chen says she feels constantly pressured to shell out money.
Yeah, I don't like Egypt.
But vendor Atrice doesn't know what else to do. He says he gets one customer a week, if he's lucky, down from five or six a day before the 2011 revolution. Pointing to horses rummaging through garbage for food, he claims things are so bad that some of the horses are starving to death.
I don't know what I'm going to do. Maybe God with me, you know? Maybe when I die, this better, you know?
For now, several tour operators are keeping Cairo stops off their itineraries until things calm down. In Cairo, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
About a year ago, the Interior Department shut down new mining on something like 1 million acres of government land near the Grand Canyon. Uranium mining, to be clear. Experts say the land around our second most visited national park holds some of the richest uranium ore deposits in the country. So mining companies are trying everything they can think of to get around that ban. From Flagstaff, KGZZ's Laurel Morales has the story.
You think the Grand Canyon is our national treasure? For miners, it's the uranium ore that's in the earth around it. A lot of energy can be produced with just a small amount of the uranium ore.
It's probably the cleanest, safest energy we have available. The rest of the world has recognized that, and so there's going to be an ongoing demand for uranium.
Don Pillmore oversees the Arizona Strip Mines for Energy Fuels Resources. He drives on a dirt road to the Arizona 1 mine, about 10 miles north of the Grand Canyon Park boundary. This mine was one of four that was grandfathered in before last year's ban. It's about the size of a Walmart parking lot. 1,000 or more feet below the surface, a couple dozen miners use explosives to blast out the ore.
That box that you see up in the headframe there, that's the man cage that the miners ride up and down into the mine on.
Underneath the cage, a giant yellow bucket turns upside down and dumps 2.5 tons of gray rock. Pillmore sticks a Geiger counter into a large pile to measure the radiation level.
Yeah, so this material right here runs about 10 pounds of uranium per ton of rock. This is about our average grade.
But environmentalists say that's a dangerous amount for anyone who lives near the Grand Canyon. It was carved out by the Colorado River, and that river still provides drinking water for nearly 40 million people.
There's literally hundreds of seeps and springs in the Grand Canyon that are potentially at risk.
Roger Clark's been fighting uranium mining companies for the Grand Canyon Trust for many years. He recently took me up in a plane over the mines to get a different perspective. From 11,000 feet, the Arizona 1 mine looks like a postage stamp. He points out how close the mine is to drainages and creeks. Scientists have found high levels of uranium in wells and springs near the mines. But mining companies have argued that uranium naturally occurs in those springs, and today's technology is so precise there's no need to worry. But Clark says it's not foolproof as we fly over a mine that recently ran into trouble. He says when they drilled down, they hit a pocket of water.
When they reopened it in 2011,
they found millions of gallons of water had filled up the shaft.
And that water likely became contaminated when it sat with the exposed uranium ore. Mining companies are trying a new strategy, going after ore deposits on state land. One company wants to mine on state land near a popular trailhead south of the canyon.
There's a few signs that trucks have been out there. They've concluded their drilling, and they know they have a valuable deposit, and they want to go after it.
And the demand for uranium is growing. Countries like India and China are desperate for uranium ore as they finish construction on several nuclear reactors. In Flagstaff, Arizona, I'm Laurel Morales for Marketplace.
Coming up, making the case for paying college athletes.
I mean, imagine if we lived in a world where Walmart and Target and Kmart could all conspire and say, well, we're all going to agree to only pay our employees $10 an hour.
First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials climbed 88 points today, about 0.6%, ended at 15,224. The NASDAQ up 5 points, nearly 0.2%, 3484 there. The S&P 500 gained 8 points, about 0.5%. Finished at 1640. Shares of Dell computed a gain of more than 3%. Today, shareholder advisory firm ISS recommended founder Michael Dell be allowed to move forward with a $24 billion buyout plan. Investors bid up shares of Alcoa 1.4% today ahead of the company's earnings report, which came after the bell. But you know what? Maybe they should have waited. The aluminum maker said it lost 11 cents a share last quarter. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note dropped off its two-year high Friday, close to 2.64% today. You're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases its monthly job openings and labor turnover survey. First Lady Michelle Obama hosts the second annual Kids State Dinner at the White House. The young guests submitted the winning recipes in a contest, the Healthy Lunchtime Challenge. And the Muslim holy month of Ramadan begins in parts of the world. The timing depends on the sighting of the new moon. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. In North Carolina today, for the 10th Monday in a row, there have been protests outside the state capitol. They come in response to cuts that the Republican-controlled legislature has made to public assistance programs there, unemployment and Medicaid among them. This is mostly a political fight, yes, but it's also become, in no small sense, a fight over what the Bible says about helping the poor. About 85% of North Carolinians say they're Christian. Many of the lawmakers proposing the cuts are Christian, as are many of the people who need public help. Marketplace's Noel King from our Wealth and Poverty Desk was at last week's protest. They're being called Moral Mondays.
Meet two people from North Carolina who are broke and looking for help anywhere they can get it. First, Kat Rhodes. Kat is one of 70,000 people who just lost federal unemployment benefits because of changes made by the state legislature. So Kat is here at the legislature to protest.
It is very dehumanizing to be in a position where you have to ask or beg for things.
When she turned to the welfare system for herself and her two children.
As taxed as the welfare system is, if you go for rental assistance, you go to try to apply for utility assistance or anything, they tell you, we don't have any money, go to your local churches.
Kat's out of luck. She's not a churchgoer. The second person I met, Charles Fuller, is.
No matter how deep the grave, no matter how high.
I found him on a Sunday at Full Gospel Tabernacle, a Pentecostal church. He's on disability, but it's not enough.
The churches do help a lot. I mean, I've been in bad shape and all financially and all since I started this church and all, and they have always stood by me and helped me.
Reverend Kevin Barber is the architect of that help and the leader of this church.
My God is alive, amen, and he's able to liberate you. He's able to set you free.
After the service, a more subdued Barber says, it's the church's responsibility to help people like Charles Fuller, not the legislature's. He says that's right there in the Bible.
Philippians 4:14, but my God shall supply all your need according to his riches in glory. My message is, don't depend on the government. Of course, It's a lot easier when you receive that unemployment. But if it runs out and if you only get 26 weeks, lean on the Lord. Lean on Him.
Now let's go 30 miles down the road to St. John's Missionary Baptist Church. Reverend Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove believes the legislature is wrong to cut assistance to the poor, especially since many of the lawmakers are Christian.
I don't mean to say that these people are not committed to Jesus and to Christianity. I mean to say, as a pastor always has to say to people at sometimes, that they're gravely wrong and that if they do not repent, they will go to hell. And unfortunately, because they're leading our state right now, our whole state will go to hell.
He says they should read the book of James.
James says, you can't say to your brother who's hungry, be thou warm and well fed. We're praying for you. Hope all's well.
This debate over what the Bible says about who should help the poor may not be new, but in North Carolina, it has a new urgency because of Reverend William Barber, no relation to Reverend Kevin Barber. He's president of the North Carolina chapter of the NAACP. He leads these weekly protests outside the state legislature. They're called Moral Mondays.
Whenever we talk about moral issues, it's about sexuality, abortion, and prayer in the school. But when we talk about budgets, we don't call moral voices. When we talk about health care, but those are the centerpieces of all our major faith. How you treat the poor, how you do justice. If you removed all the scriptures that deal with that, you wouldn't have a Bible.
We don't have any more money to pull out of a magic hat.
That's State Senator Tom Goolsbee, also a Christian. He says he respects the protesters' right to voice their opinions.
They've been polite. They sing very well.
But he says the Republican majority was voted in fair and square, and they're trying to get the state out of debt. Downstairs, Reverend Barber and 1,000 or so protesters are out on the lawn again.
We refuse to give up.
We refuse to give up.
We stood on our principles. We stood on our principles.
They're not all motivated by faith. Some hold signs that quote the Bible on helping the poor. Some call for women's rights or marriage equality. A few dozen people are putting their bodies on the line for their beliefs today. They wear green armbands. That means they expect to be arrested. To applause, they march into the General Assembly building. They stand together, singing, until the police say they must leave. But they don't. They're handcuffed by the police and, still singing, marched off to jail. Barber says the protesters will keep this up every Monday, as long as the legislature is in session. I'm Noelle King for Marketplace.
We're in that downtime that happens every summer in college sports. The NCAA basketball tournament is over. College football hasn't started yet. The College World Series has come and gone without too many people noticing. But in a courtroom in Oakland, California, the business end of college sport is alive and well. The question at particular issue in the lawsuit against the NCAA isn't new. Should student-athletes be paid for their services, services that are in some sports oh so lucrative for their schools? What is new, though, is how seriously this particular challenge to the NCAA's business model is being taken. Here's one indicator. Moody's, the credit rating people, have revised the NCAA's credit outlook to negative. Dr. Boyce Watkins is a scholar in residence at Syracuse University. He's written on this case. Dr. Watkins, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
This is, you have written, a pretty clear-cut case of labor rights. Explain that a little bit.
Yes, well, I believe that every American deserves to have labor rights. If you really look at the numbers, I'm a finance guy, that's what I do, you'll see that the NCAA makes money on par with every professional sports league in the world. I mean, imagine if we lived in a world where Walmart and Target and Kmart could all conspire and say, well, we're all going to agree to only pay our employees $10 an hour. That would be entirely unacceptable. But that's what happens when Duke and North Carolina and Kentucky all agree that we're not going to compensate the athletes. It just leads to a system that I would say is inherently unfair.
How much of a problem is it? Or maybe has this become a bigger issue because so many of the players in so many of these sports come from poverty and, in fact, so many of them are African-American?
Well, you know, I think that the poverty issue does exacerbate the problem. I think that race does play a role in that at least $1 billion in economic
value is stripped from the black community every single year. When you have a kid like a Reggie Bush, for example, who played at USC, who ended up losing his Heisman because his mom got a few thousand dollars under the table. But when you look back and you see that USC, a school with an endowment that's larger than every historically black college in the country combined, that this school made over $100 million from Reggie Bush's play on the field, it's hard to argue that some people shouldn't be a little bit outraged about that.
The NCAA, of course, uses phrases like scholar-athlete with some sense of determination. They also say, you know what, the revenue that, I don't know, USC or Syracuse gets from basketball or football or whatever, lets the female volleyball players play. And if we get rid of, you know, the money we're making, then everybody's out of luck.
You know, when you talk about the idea that the revenue is being shared amongst different sports, I think that's kind of an interesting argument, because when you talk about the coaches, no one ever says, well, if you pay the coach, the basketball coach, $5 million, then you've only got $100,000 to pay the volleyball coach. But for some reason, when it comes to the athletes, we expect this subsidization model to apply, which I'm not going to argue the merits of it one way or the other, but I'm going to say that it's kind of odd for you to come to me and say, look, I earned you $10 million. I'd like a percentage of that. And for me to say, well, I'd like to give you your money, but I've already given it to somebody else.
I don't disagree with you, but you are not the first guy to call the NCAA corrupt. Taylor Branch famously did it in the Atlantic Magazine a year or two ago in a blistering article. And yet, it has not changed its ways, and there does not seem to be substantive pressure on the NCAA to change its ways in any fashion that's going to be successful.
I would argue that the NCAA does change its ways in that they tend to be a lot more defensive about their business model. They spend a lot more money every year marketing and trying to get the public to believe that they are something that I believe that they're not. I think that what's going to probably happen is that at some point, some outside entity, perhaps the IRS or Congress or the courts, are going to step in and break the NCAA down. Because the toughest thing about dealing with the NCAA is that they kind of operate in a sovereign space. They regulate themselves. And when you look throughout society, any institution that regulates itself is usually going to be filled with corruption.
Dr. Boyce Watkins, he's a scholar in residence at Syracuse University. He is, as you said, a finance guy. Professor Watkins, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, in which the market, broadly speaking, gets just the teensiest bit more fair. Thomson Reuters, the financial information conglomerate, has agreed to stop letting its paying clients get an early look at consumer sentiment numbers from the University of Michigan. Reuters pays Michigan for exclusive distribution rights to that data, and in turn had been letting its highest paying customers have the data early. 2 seconds before its regular paying clients. Yes, just 2 seconds, but in the world of high-frequency trading, that is practically eons. But no more. As of Friday, all Reuters clients, not just the high rollers, get the data at the same time, which is to say they get it 5 minutes before the rest of us do. Like I said, the market's got just a teensy bit more fair. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Our producers include Lina Anwar, Bridget Bodner, Mary Dew, Nancy Fargali, Millie Jefferson, John Ketsum, Jolie Myers, and Chow Tu. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. And this is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.